Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The coronavirus has South Dakotans thinking twice about holding events, school, and even opening the doors of their businesses. Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Ten Haken promises a big announcement at 1 o'clock today. And the remaining days of the 2020 legislative session, the Dakota Political Junkies are back. Today we welcome Jonathan Ellis with the Argus Leader. Welcome back, Jonathan. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here, Lori.
Also joining us by phone, John Schaff. He's professor of political science at Northern State University in Aberdeen. Welcome back, Professor Schaff.
Good to be here.
All right, let's start with coronavirus updates and how communities are handling them, political messaging, and the works. Jonathan Ellis, where do you kind of want to begin? We knew this was coming, and now we're looking at the first press conferences and the State Department of Health resources website. State was ready for communication during this, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they had prepared the way, at least for us, the media, with regular sort of updates. So, I mean, and you're right, it was only kind of a matter of time. Now, things are in great flux, and I think, even by the end of the day, there'll be probably a lot of changes that we'll hear, announcements throughout the course of the day. As communities react to all of this, I had Commissioner Jeff Barth, Minnehaha County Commissioner Jeff Barth, today saying that he thinks the communities need to be doing a lot more in order to be prepared for people who are very sick. Instead of going to the hospitals, he's suggesting that the county or the cities look at converting unused buildings into makeshift clinics. I think he thinks that we should be doing some drive-through testing. There's a wide variety of responses. We're having a St. Patrick's Day parade. He would like that to be canceled. So that's his view. I think that as we progress more and more into this, that's a view that will be more widely shared.
And that's a really excellent point, that you think you're ready, and then it comes to, and we saw the case with the West Central Schools in Hartford and Humboldt closed today because a family had traveled and they're going to do some cleaning there. The children don't have COVID-19, but they're being cautious. And superintendents have to make the decision about how to communicate that to people. Nursing homes do. John, how about colleges, places like Northern State, where you're right in that sort of spring break time frame, people traveling, coming home? How are some colleges and universities, in your experience, handling this fear?
Well, let's talk about it in two ways. I can talk about what's happening nationally, and I can say a little bit about what's happening here in the state. We've seen, I think the first one to go is University of Washington, since Seattle was, I guess, one of the first places to have a relatively significant outbreak of coronavirus, and then Stanford followed up, and then Harvard, then Amherst, and now I see Indiana University is shutting down. I saw Grinnell College in Iowa is closing up shop, because it happens to be that a lot of places like South Dakota, we're on spring break right now. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of places are deciding, as long as the students are away, why have them come back, just so they might have to leave again. And that makes a lot of sense. What we're doing here in this, and so I think you're going to see more and more of that happening, is that universities, which already, all right, I can tell you, being at a university for 19 years, we are a cesspool of disease during cold and flu season. It's just the way it is. When you get people congregated close together, we spread flu around, we spread colds, we spread strep. And so I think if there's any indication of a threat, schools are gonna make an action. What we've got here in the state of South Dakota, what we've been getting, I think the northern state where I teach, and I assume a lot of this is coming from the Regento level as well, I think they've been doing a pretty good job of keeping us updated. We got an email right away yesterday about the outbreak here in the state of South Dakota, and as much as probably 2 weeks ago, I would say, is when we got the first indication where we were told as faculty, saying, hey, we're not telling you anything, but start thinking about what you would do if we had to close the university. And now we've got a protocol called the Continuity of Instruction Plan, which is basically we're going to go online, which is what most people are doing. And we've got some protocols in place about how we're going to deliver things and how we're going to communicate with people And then those students who this isn't going to work for, we're going to deal with on an individual basis. There might be students who, if they are at home, they don't have internet. They might, for familial reasons, for family reasons, have to be in one place rather than another. We're going to deal with that on a case-by-case basis. But I think we've got it covered. I hope we don't have to use it. But as you guys indicate, these things tend to start slowly. That's the whole point of exponential growth. It starts slowly and it adds up really quickly. So we'll see where this goes.
Right. And right now we have five positive cases of one death in Pennington County. And those numbers, Jonathan, are updated by the Department of Health by 5 o'clock every day. We are going to see those grow as testing grows because we really haven't had the testing at this point to test large numbers of people.
Yeah, that's not a surprise. I think that health experts have been warning that the numbers are going to go up quite a bit exponentially, as John says. And you saw Angela Merkel in Germany made headlines today. She's a scientist, and she basically said that expect 70% of Germany's population to be infected with this. And I think at the end of the day, this will probably go down as sort of a failure. Of public health across the world, of identifying this early and then taking the appropriate steps. If 70% of the population is getting infected in a westernized country with a great health system, and I don't know if you guys saw the New York Times story today or yesterday, I think it was, that came out on the CDC's failure, how a scientist in Seattle was trying to test people with her own kind of makeshift test, and they told her she can't do this, and they found, I mean, it's a fascinating story, and at the end of the day of government bungling of this. So I think there'll be a lot as this, maybe I sound cynical that this can be stopped at this point, but I think we'll see. At 5 o'clock, I would expect to see the numbers be going up mm-hmm. probably every day for a while.
John Schaff, we're in an election year. We're in a divided nation where people are, thrilled to point out the failures of an administration or thrilled to point out the failures of the opposing party in some ways. How does this all play out from a political science standpoint, and how can that be? I mean, I'm making an assumption here that that division can be really, really bad for people from a public health standpoint. Talk about the intersection between public health crises and politics.
Well, I often use the analogy that we'll use the president of the United States, but I think this would probably go for any chief executive, say a governor. You get too much credit when things are good and too much blame when things are bad. And so, Donald Trump was bragging about the stock market a couple weeks ago. I bet he's not bragging as much now. And neither one of them were really his fault. But that's just sort of what you sign up for when you get in those positions, because what John Ellis is talking about the failures of the CDC or the government, these are technical failures. That are really beyond the capacity usually of a chief executive, not unlike, but an example is when you have the disaster of Katrina in New Orleans. Actually, the federal response to the hurricane in New Orleans was the best response to a natural disaster the federal government had ever had. They got more goods to the disaster faster than they had ever done before. The failure was largely state and local, but nonetheless, George Bush got blamed for it. And that's just, as I say, it's sort of what you sign up for. And so I think that whether Donald Trump is to blame or not, he's probably going to get some of the blame. What you would hope is that, as you indicate, Lori, we live in these very divisive times. We've talked about it many times on this show, that this would be an opportunity to come together and to come to a common agreement about what we want to do. And when someone, inevitably failures are going to happen. I think it's just when you've got something of this level, it's going to be easy to pick out particular failures. Now we want to correct those failures. And if some particular person has failed, maybe that person needs to be removed and replaced with somebody else. But maybe we can minimize the amount of political hay to be made out of the inevitable failures and try to make something better. And I guess we'll see how that plays out. But on a strictly partisan basis, it doesn't help to be an office holder right now, because those are the ones who are going to get blamed. And whether they deserve it or not, and I'm suggesting that they probably don't, but I think that's how this usually plays out.
So two questions about that, John. One is about messaging, and this president, I've heard him say several times, it wasn't my fault, it's not my fault, it's not our fault. He doesn't seem particularly comfortable with the idea that, you know, of not reminding people that it's not his fault. And so my first question is what's strong leadership right now from an executive, a governor, a president? Should you be reminding every people that this wasn't your fault, or should you just be taking charge and saying, we're going to deal with it?
Well, certainly the latter rather than the former, I would think. And this, I think I've tried to be a little bit kind to President Trump, so now let me give him some criticism, is that the failures of the Trump administration at the highest levels, and they're probably, as Jonathan indicates, there are bureaucratic failures, but those are usually below the level of policymaking. At the policymaking level, the highest levels, the problem is precisely one of the pathologies of Donald Trump is he tends to take every incident and personalize it and make it about himself. And so he seems to be overly concerned about whether he's getting blamed or not rather than doing something about it. And when we have the inevitability, I think, at this point of the necessity of very strong public actions, some of which are going to hurt, right? It's not fun to have your school closed. Think of what parents are going to have to go through trying to adjust care for their children, what it's going to do to their work lives. And we have sporting events or major events canceled, parades canceled, and when people have planned for these things and spent enormous amounts of money getting them ready, and then they don't happen or they happen at a very small scale, that hurts. And so the president needs to be saying that, I mean, he needs to be reassuring us not to panic, but also what he should have been doing probably a week, if not 2 weeks ago, is getting the people of the country mentally prepared for what will probably have to be very tough decisions, and saying, we hope it doesn't come to this, but you should be prepared that this is going to be canceled. Your access to certain things is going to be limited. We have the community of New Rochelle in New York on Long Island, which is now under 80,000 people under quarantine. That's tough. And you have to prepare people mentally for that. And when the president has tried to minimize the extent of the threat, and now I think inevitably the reality of the threat is coming to bear, it's actually going to make him look weaker than he otherwise would have, and it seems like he's got to pivot rather quickly to changing his rhetoric.
Jonathan, I wanted to talk to you about this, the role of media at this point and handling, you know, with the governor's press conference, there were moments when I was watching thinking there was some discomfort with saying things that really are just the reality. So let's talk. And then, of course, you've got social media, Jonathan, where everybody thinks they're a reporter and they can snap a photo of an empty shelf at their local store and start spreading stories that may or may not be fully researched or even accurate. What kind of conversations do you have in a newsroom? I know what we've had around here about accuracy and ethics at this point, but for our listeners, Jonathan, tell us a little bit about the role of media in kind of getting at the truth of this information and holding people accountable for the things they say and how they disseminate that information, but also just being the source to go to for your local community.
Well, I did not have an opportunity to see the press conference yesterday. I'm working on another story that will be breaking here in the next 24 hours that you'll want to talk about next week. But, hopefully, if we're doing our jobs correctly, we're providing enough factual information out there without actually, as media, without you know, hyping things and making it seem maybe worse than it is. I mean, that's hopefully what we're doing, and we're doing our jobs in that way. There's also a time to, as you mentioned, hold people accountable for what went wrong, what didn't go wrong, I don't know that we're necessarily at that point, although I did mention that New York Times story, and it was very good, and I also have to agree with basically everything John said. I mean, this in terms of political, this was a bureaucratic failing, I don't think it would matter who was president, but there will be a time for the autopsy on all of this and to go back in the media and to determine what went wrong, where, and how things can be fixed.
Certainly people are talking about this president's not having a pandemic task force, the firing of people and the budgeting of CDC and other places. So some of those criticisms are directed at the president because of administrative decisions he made before the pandemic. And the World Health Organization has now declared coronavirus a pandemic. So that word is in play because of the severity of this worldwide. So much more that we'll be talking about in this case. But a few other things that are also happening. And Jonathan, do you want to touch real quick on this whole Mayor Paul Ten Hankin with a Wednesday announcement that sort of started some rumors that, did that messaging get away from him? Explain a little bit of what he's trying to do here by teasing people about a big announcement.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's tuning in at 1 o'clock, I guess, on a Facebook Live. But you're right. I mean, pretty soon, you know, people started speculating. Again, this is social media. We mentioned social media. Speculating about what this could be, and you know, could it be a big tax break? Could it be running for another office? So, yeah, there's been a lot of speculation fueled mainly on social media about what this is going to be. I think for people in Sioux Falls, it will be interesting. And, but it's definitely took on a life of its own out there on social media.
Right. All right. We are in the final days of the South Dakota legislative session. Got to talk funding, got to talk pay increases for teachers. John Schaff, a lot. We're used to this as well. We know that appropriations is a big deal, and it usually comes at the end, last minute.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, I don't know, at the beginning of the week, it wasn't clear exactly what was going to happen, or maybe end of last week when, the governor was asking for pay increases for, frankly, people like me, state employees, mm-hmm. Teachers, some members of the legislature, especially Lee Qualm, maybe frowning upon that, because it is the case that since the beginning of session, or especially since the governor gave her budget address in December, it looks like revenues have come in healthier than anticipated, and so now the discussion is what do we do with those unanticipated revenues, and it looks like they've come to some sort of consensus, some sort of compromise that teachers will get a pay raise, and yippee, state employees will get a pay raise, and then we'll see how other things. I think they're perhaps even as we speak, they're working through exactly what's going to happen on industrial hemp, and sort of as often happens, the biggest decisions are saved. And so what we talked about probably as session opened, things like in industrial hemp. And budgets, this is what we're talking about at the end, and they're going to wait until last. We've got just a few more days left, and we'll see what exactly passes, what can exactly get a majority vote in the legislature.
Jonathan Ellis, what can you tell us about things that you're tuned in to as the session wraps up? What are you hoping to learn?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the budget's going to be the big issue, and I think I predicted at the start of the legislative session that there would be a raise for the various stakeholders who depend upon state employees and teachers. I think I predicted that. It's actually a little more than I think I predicted. I think I said at least maybe 1%. But so
you've probably got tape somewhere. We can call it the Jonathan Ellison was right tape. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I bet you do have it. I'm not surprised by that. I think that people complain, why are they waiting the last day to do the budget? But I mean, I think it's because,
is that the voice they use? Is that the actual voice?
I've heard it. All right. people complain about that. Why don't we just do it in the beginning? Well, I mean, you get better estimates, as John said. I mean, revenue estimates come in. It's appropriate. You have to go through many hearings. The Appropriations Committee goes through. I mean, they really grind through all of the requests that the various departments make. And so it's not something you just magically do. So they actually do a lot of work in order to get to this point. So the budget, of course, is a big one. Industrial hemp, that's also a big one. The Chamber of Commerce has been wanting to get Spanish driver's tests in Spanish for driver's license. It looks like that's going to happen. So, you know, a few things coming together at the end for sure. And then, you know, we'll see what the governor ends up vetoing and whether there's any need for them to go back for veto day later this month.
Anybody have any predictions about that? What, is she have her pen ready to veto something?
I don't know that she telegraphed anything. Maybe Jonathan's heard something. I don't know that she's telegraphed. But there's probably no doubt something out there is going to get vetoed. But I haven't heard her threatening a veto. But it's also possible she's done it and I've missed it. So,
yeah, she hasn't been as vocal this time about coming out against things, you know, as publicly as I think she was in her first session, especially in particular with that hemp bill. So there might be a surprise there.
She's been clear about her guardrails.
I wonder what the language is going to be on the so-called riot boosting bill, and whether. You know, I suspect she'll sign them no matter what, but there's some indication that the language is changing slightly, and we'll see if it's acceptable to the governor or not.
Right. I'm really interested to find out about the expansion of 211 and that mental health legislation, whether or not they're going to fund continued studies on that. So all that is up in the air still. Jonathan Schaaf and John Schaaf and Jonathan Ellis, thanks so much for being here. We appreciate both of your time.
Thanks a lot for having us.